My name is Matt Homan. I'm the founder and CEO of Filament. And the worst advice I ever got was that you shouldn't do stuff that's cool if you're pretty certain no one's done it before.
Oh, wow, dude, that's great advice, Nat. Holy cow, what kind of suckwad gave you that advice, Nat?
Well, I was a lawyer, remember, Phil? So,
that's right.
But law practice is about precedent and the race to be first to be second. And I learned that fundamentally that people try to talk you out of doing cool things, not because they're afraid you'll fail, but they're afraid you'll succeed and then they'll have to change with you. So even back in the day when I was practicing law and I was trying all this new stuff, I was being innovative, at least for lawyers, and that's an oxymoron to most. But I would constantly have my peers tell me, God, that sounds kind of neat, but you probably really shouldn't do it because no one else is doing it. And it's not worth the effort. Just go along. Now, the truth is I would have made a lot more money had I just gone along. But I may have ended it, or certainly at least my career, had I been stuck kind of following the path, the well-worn, well-trodden path of everyone else.
That's funny, man. Yeah, well, so that's an interesting thing. You were an attorney, and you were a blogger, though. You started on the blog like I did, right? Your Lex Think blog was fantastic. I remember because you write some interesting stuff, and I'm like, but he's an attorney. It can't be so provocative. How is that possible? And yet it was, man. So you got to tell me, like, as an attorney, why did you start blogging, man? Was that because of that bad advice and you just decided to swim upstream or what?
You know, I was early in blogging for lawyers, too. I don't know if there was 50 of us at the time or 100. There wasn't any more than that, and it might have been less. And so blogging for me initially was almost a knowledge management tool. It was a place for me to capture the cool things that I found elsewhere. And I started writing because no one else was writing about this stuff. Had I started 6 months or a year later, I probably would have never started at all because I was using it to kind of scratch my itch for connecting, for sharing, for finding cool things. Our newsletter now kind of does the same thing. And had it been easier to do that on my own in private, I probably would have. So when I started saying, and you give me an unbelievable amount of credit because most of my stuff was finding something that lawyers would have otherwise never seen. It could have been something as easy as a thought from Seth Godin or from you and being able to share it back to what was predominantly a legal audience at the beginning and say, hey, lawyers, this is how the rest of the world's thinking about stuff. You can think about it this way too.
Yeah, well, I think that's interesting. And thank you for saying Gerbyshack and Godin in the same sentence. Usually the only time that works is when they say these do not exist together. So thank you for that, Matt. I appreciate that mention with Seth Godin. But really, that was what was genius is most attorneys felt like they had to be the smartest person in the room. And you always felt like, hey, I have a lot I can learn here. Now, that being said, one of the things that I do admire about you, again, is that you would plug that in to your lawyer community, right? You would make sense of it, give it some context, which anybody can learn from, right? I mean, marketing is marketing is marketing. Sales is sales is sales. Best business practices are best business practices, but are best business practices. But you gave it context. So talk about the importance of context, because I think as we move into talking about why meetings suck and how to make them suck less, I think that's an important piece.
I think that, so in our work, and we facilitate meetings, really creative ones, we get to be in rooms of super smart people all the time, is they are ultimately thinking through the exact same problem, right? So the context is interesting, is that I think we give context in many ways way more credit than it's due. So how many times have you heard someone in a particular industry say, oh, yeah, but we're different? And nowhere is that more true than in law, right? Everyone, oh, lawyers are different. They're even the ones who call everyone else non-lawyers, as if the rest of the world that was smart enough not to go to law school is somehow deficient in some way. And so the context for me is understanding what is the same versus what is different. Whether we think about the chimpanzees sharing 99% of our DNA, as humans, most of the industries and businesses have the exact same problems. They've got people to manage. They've got outcomes to achieve. They've got money to collect. And fundamentally, they have ideas they've got to test. And we keep on looking only inwards to our own industries versus looking elsewhere and saying, wow, their context is different because they're a different industry, but everything else is the same. What can I learn from them? How can I be more, think of myself as more similar to them versus more different? because it's too easy to look for the differences. I mean, we see it in politics, we see it in social media, but man, everyone has got so many of the exact same problems, and they don't get to learn from everyone else who solved them maybe 6 months or 6 years ago, because it's not in their industry. And consultants drive that a bit as well, right? I'm a specialist in this, so I can't help you think about change. Well, guess what? I can think about change because everybody's dealing with it on a regular basis. And here's a little slice over here that may be worthy for you to apply over here versus ignoring it because it's not validated by all of your peers.
I think that's really interesting. And that, I think, is the beauty of the internet, right? We have that interconnectedness of where we find those common crossing points, those common intersections, those common things that we do, and then taking the 1 or 2% that are different, saying, okay, I'm just going to dial it up a little bit. I'm going to turn that on a little bit. But we have to get the heck out of our own heads and say, you know what? Only my industry can do this. That's bullcrap. That's just not how this works. Ever. It's never been that way. I mean, the fundamentals are the same. Fundamentals are the fundamentals. And that's so darn important. So fundamentals. Let's talk about meeting fundamentals, because Matt, at the Filament, man, you do some really good stuff. And to your point, your newsletter is awesome, man, because it is wonderfully curated. I read it, and then I also look for it on LinkedIn, which is comical, because often I read it and I just skim it. And then I go to LinkedIn, I'm like, oh yeah, Matt's freaking brilliant. I always forget about this. So talk to me about why do the traditional meetings suck, first of all.
You know, it's a great question. I think that to back up a bit, meetings are terrible because no one works at being better at meetings, right? At some point, we've learned to type and gotten to a certain level because we use typing every day. We've learned to use Excel or the other tools we've used at this level of competency because we assume it'll help us do our work better. But so few people have ever seen really good meetings that they have a model or a peer to look forward to and say, that's how you do it. And, you know, I think about it as a meeting, just in general. And there's so many challenges with meetings. And I'll talk about in-person ones. A lot of these apply to the virtual ones as well. But I was reading someone shared this one time, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. Said, in most organizations, it may take a junior person 8 layers of approval to spend $10,000. But they can, with no approvals or oversight, put a $10,000 meeting on the calendar every day or every week for a year, right? Because an 8-hour meeting, a 1-hour meeting with 8 people is an 8-hour meeting. We spend so much of our organization's time in meetings, yet we spend so little time trying to master them. Meetings should not be for information delivery. If I've got to tell you something, there's so many better ways for me to do that than to use 8 hours of time collectively to share a PowerPoint. Meetings should be focused on 1 or 2 things at most. Is this a decision-making meeting? Is this a brainstorming meeting? Is this a collaboration meeting? Are we doing work together? But people don't even come to their meetings with any intention. And I'll happy to share a PDF out in the show notes with you that kind of help you think about some of these questions to ask. Even prep, I'm convinced that meetings are fundamentally the last refuge of the procrastinator. Right? Maybe not the last refuge, but if you're a procrastinator, guess what? You'll set a meeting 2 weeks from now, because then you don't have to do that work until 13 days from now. And so oftentimes meetings are a tactic for procrastinators to delay necessary outputs versus sending an email, recording a simple video, sharing the ideas, et cetera, that they would otherwise share in that meeting. And so I think meetings are bad in organizations because we don't take time learning how to be better at them. Yet a 5% improvement in your meeting effectiveness could have $1 billion of impact in a large organization. And people just don't spend the time thinking about it. The other thing is that when you start to look into bigger meetings, right, whether you think of them as offsites, conferences, retreats, summits, et cetera, there's this bifurcation of planning, the person who owns the planning of the logistics and the person who owns the outcome, right? Meeting planners don't have enough power. They've not been given it. So they build a beautiful box for the same terrible meeting to live in over and over and over again, right? The trains run on time, the coffee's hot, the cookies are fresh, everything is amazing, but that dude is reading his PowerPoint again, right? Because the content, the outcome, the sell more, engage better, be smarter, learn this, learn that, is rarely owned by the people who plan the meeting. It's owned by the people who parachute in at the end. They say rooms filled with panel tables and PowerPoint screens and classroom style. And like, oh, okay, let's just do a slightly better version of what we did last year. And so there's so many reasons why meetings are bad, but the one is that people haven't experienced good ones, right? Whether it's great conferences, an amazingly facilitated summit, or even a well-planned 10-person strategy session. We don't have a lot of, this was amazing, I want it to be more like that, in our memory bank. So we just default to the same, to try a marginally better version of the same one from last year.
Wow. That makes so much sense, right? I put it on the screen there. Meetings are bad because most people haven't experienced a good one, which is what, exactly what you said. And I totally agree with you. I'm thinking back. I have seen so few good meetings in my life. It's disappointing, to say the least, because often, to your point about procrastination, which I totally love, it's a great way to kick the can down the curb, right? And say, oh, hold on. Let's make that decision in 2 weeks, because that's when our schedules match up.
Right.
As opposed to, hey, Matt, here's your responsibility. Hey, Phil, here's yours. Hey, Susie Q, here's your explanation. Hey, Sally, here's yours. That we just kick the can down the curb and billions of dollars are wasted because right. We don't make decisions.
Right. And if we think, and so use decision-making as one possibility. How many meetings, no one knows if there's a decision to be made, who owns that decision. They don't give any context for it. So if I'm an introvert, I might want to process this a little bit more than someone who might be an extrovert who wants to think out loud in the room. Even in that situation, you say, here's the decision we're going to make today. Here's who owns it. It might be me as the meeting planner. It might be my boss, right? Here's the inputs I want from each of you. Here's some context. Come and be prepared to talk about your recommendation, and then I'll decide, right? And even in meetings, and this is one thing that came out of a meeting design summit that we hosted at Filament, is that you should have two lists at the end of every meeting. The decisions we made, and the decisions we need, right? Because there's time that there are people in the meeting that aren't the right people. You need to get budgetary approval. You need to get your boss's boss to go answer something. You may just have some information you don't have available to you in the moment. By capturing that decisions we need, you then assign that. Say, Phil, this is a decision we need. Go get it for us. And you might find that your boss or your boss's boss says, hey, you guys have that. I don't care what you do. Or do it within these parameters. And then you come back and you get to make the decision. But decisions don't even happen in meetings. And there's times where, I see this is the word that drives me crazy. People want alignment in meetings. And we've done this. We've tried this. I said, I want you all to define what alignment means. Is it 51%? Is it a supermajority? Is it everyone agrees? Is it we all understand? Like, what is even alignment? And if you can't define it, you can't get to it. And so it's just so many of those little pieces that we enter into these meetings with no preparation. And we're stacking them just like the easiest game of Tetris, 1 hour, 1 hour, 1 hour, 30 minutes, 30 minutes, 1 hour, that you don't even have time to be thoughtful about the meetings you're going to be entering. One simple tip is that I think every meeting that was an hour should be shortened to 47 minutes. 47 is a number that people can't add more than two or three in a row. So you at least build generally a 13-minute gap in your calendar before the next meeting. If you want to be really smart, start your meetings at 13 minutes after the hour versus on the hour, because then you'll just run to the top of the hour because that's how everyone else's mind is working. And give some people some time to be thoughtful. Generally meetings don't do that.
Wow. 47 minutes. So I do 25 and 50, because that's Google's, quicker, swifter meetings or whatever. But 47, it's odd enough that it makes people go like, what? What's that? Which hopefully means that they'll prep. But your tip about starting at 13 past, my challenge in most organizations that I've worked in as an employee and that I promise to root out as an owner of a business, and that is people showing up late drive me crazy. Like, there's no reason to be late. And your 13-minute past makes it so that probably I'll get there at 10 past, which now makes me early. Is that what you see as well, or what's your...
Yeah, but there is every reason that they're late is because their calendar is filled with meetings they don't control, of people they report to that go back to back to back to back to back to back. And so virtually, you at least have an easier chance to kind of pop from one to the other. But when we were in person, there's a reason in high school and junior high and grade school, they give you a bell and a time in between periods. You got to go to your locker, right?
Yeah. Here, transition time.
You got to go to, like, we don't build that in at all. And we assume that if I set a calendar meeting for an hour and yours goes to an hour, that I'm more important than you. You should start yours late versus me ending mine early. And then the meeting conversation expands to whatever time we give it. And it starts late because people come late because they just finished another meeting. So, I mean, even just thinking about how you calendar meetings can have a really significant impact in not only productivity of your organization, but literally the sanity of the people who come in. The other thing that Amazon does, I think, particularly well, is that they might say, okay, you're here for the first 15 minutes. Read this. Right? I know that you're not going to read it that you said you might have before we started. So read this. And then we'll talk about it.
Wow. Wow. So that's almost baking in the prep time into the meeting, right? That's almost giving people a bit to prep. Now, how does that work with an introvert though, Matt? Because you and I, right, we'll ref for weeks on this stuff. But what about those people that need the process time? How does that work? How far in advance should we send it?
It depends on how much you're asking them to consider. What I would do is I would say to them, here's what we're going to talk about, right? Whether there's a pre-read or not, here's what we're going to talk about. Here's the questions I want you to be prepared to talk about when we get there. Capture two or three bullet points before we begin. Now, you can do that in a shared document, whether it's in Microsoft Word or in Google Docs or whatever. And if you say, my expectation before we start is I'm going to have three ideas or suggestions or comments from each of you before this meeting begins, you can do it today. You can do it the night before, whatever it is. And then as a facilitator, even the owner of the meeting, introverts aren't quiet, right? They just need to think about something. And so to be able to pull them and say, hey, I see, Phil, that you've talked about this. Mind sharing a bit more, right? You're able to pull that out into the room. And virtually, it's even more crucial because in person, you can use body language. You can use attention to kind of draw some of that out. It's really easy to hide in a sea of Brady Bunch, Hollywood Squares faces on the screen, because while you feel like everyone's staring at you, you also can assume that no one's staring at you. So giving people that opportunity, and then you can say, hey, everybody, here's what we're going to talk about. Here's the decisions we're going to make. Here's the comments. If you give me the comments or you don't care, you don't show up at the meeting.
Wow. And you give them that option. So then what do people do, Matt, if they don't attend meetings? I don't understand.
They get work done, Phil, right? I know you're saying that tongue in cheek. They get work done. They get to prepare for the other meetings. They get to be thoughtful. They get to close their door and actually think about stuff. That's the problem, is that in a traditional day inside the office, how much time do you have to think about stuff? All right. In our model at Filament, even when we're virtual, but in person, we want to do in the room, virtually or otherwise, only things you can do in the room. We don't do PowerPoint. We've not had a PowerPoint slide shown at Filament. We've got about a 20,000 square foot meeting space. We've not had a PowerPoint slide shown at Filament for almost 3 years now. Not a single slide. Because information delivery does not need to happen in person. Insight discovery needs to happen in person. So if we're in the room together, let's do what we can only do in person. That's conversations, collaboration, it's brainstorming, it's being thoughtful, it's Q&A. And leave that PowerPoint for people to read, because they read it faster than you can speak to it anyway. Right? If I'm reading a slide, my audience reads it 3 to 4 times faster than I generally discuss it. And so I lose them every slide for 75% of the time we're together. If I give them it as a pre-read and then I still insist upon reading the slide, you know, they're going to wait till I get to the one thing they care about and check out the entire rest of the time. So there's just so many little best practices, and no one spends time thinking about it. And it comes from the top, right? It comes from the top, that if I've not, you know, I've got to look smart, and the best way for me to look smart when my boss is in the room is to talk the entire time. And to share this PowerPoint that I spent so much time getting these really cool transitions of this new font that I found, right? I mean, versus being thoughtful and running a better meeting.
Yeah. No, you're so right. And it's so comical because often they either, I've seen so many decks put together that are abysmal that if they sent them ahead of time, I wouldn't show up to your meeting. Like, I can just read everything that you have. Now the best to that point is shorter slides, but then offer that preparation time so that we can discuss it. So that, Matt, you and I can have a conversation about this and say, okay, so here's the important stuff. You read it ahead of time, right? And now we're ready to go. Or if not, let's stop right now. To your point, if we still have to have an hour meeting because we don't listen to Matt, we don't do 47 minutes. The first 30 minutes then are for all those losers that didn't read ahead of time, that now you're going to sit quietly and read yourself, right? And the rest of you can take a nap or whatever it is that you're going to do. So what do you think?
No, I think that's right. And you know that. And at some point, the leader has to say, did everybody read this? Yes, 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 no. All right, you're out. Like, have some, you know, if you're going to commit to better meeting practices, it's got to come from the top and you've got to commit. I'll give you another example is that, you know, if you've got the stat, let's say you have the 90-minute once weekly staff meeting, right? The better way to even approach that is to say, okay, everyone on Sunday night or better on Friday, send these. You got to send them on Friday because we don't want you obsessing over the weekend. Send by Friday at 1 o'clock. The three things you want to report out could be help you need, could be what you're working on. It could be kind of that standard scrum sort of stand up sort of ideas, right? Anything cool you found. And then I'm expecting everyone to read it ahead of time. And then what we're able to do is then we're able to discuss it. And so now you turn your 90-minute meeting into probably half of that. But then instead of giving people back those 45 minutes in the calendar, you say it's blocked for 90 minutes. Any collaboration and help you need, we're all here in this room. So now I'm going to pull Phil aside and say, hey, Phil, that one thing I've been trying to get on your calendar for, let's talk about that for 5 minutes. And then I find someone else, say, oh, hey, Matt, over there, will you give me that help on this? And so what you're also able to do is carve out time where your team are all there to collaborate for those little itty-bitty things that otherwise take, you know, it's an hour or 30-minute calendar invite because that's the default. But I really just need a few minutes of help. But it's work time. It's not meeting time. But again, you're pulling everyone together to get that done in the room.
Wow. I hadn't heard of that before. And that just makes a lot of sense as I'm processing and thinking about that. I mean, the fact that you could actually get to the stakeholders that you need to get to for 5 to 7 minutes at a shot, and you know that this is the time, how much more would you prep if you knew that for 5 to 7 minutes you could get that executive's attention, right? How much more would you be ready to make an ask and maybe practice that ask? If you're a nervous person, if you're not used to speaking off the cuff, which again gives our folks who are, you know, who are more introverted that opportunity to do that. But also it then gives those executives a chance to think about, oh, I better show up for that meeting. Right. Because frankly, people are counting on me to be there as opposed to just counting on me because they think they somehow need my blessing in order to do that. So I think that makes a lot of sense, Matt.
Well, you also think about the load on everyone's time. Is that again, if you get a 10-person meeting, and I'm the executive, right? And so I'm using that hour meeting with 10 people. I'll see if I can do the math in my head to have everyone report to me, right? So for that hour meeting, 6 minutes are me and you together, if you're my boss, and the rest of it is me waiting on those 6 minutes from everybody else. Right. So that 10-person meeting for an hour is a 10-hour meeting. However, if I spend as your boss or as my boss, those 6 minutes one-on-one, whether it's video chat, whether it's me walking around doing management by walking around, we've now cut the load of that meeting by almost 8 hours. Right. Because it's still 60 minutes, you know, it's 60 minutes for me, 6 minutes, but it's 6 minutes for you kind of coming back. But each of those, you know, the bulk of those, so now you have 10, 12-minute conversations versus, you know, so 2 hours versus 10 hours.
Eight or 10. Yeah.
And the people don't do the costing. They don't think about the math of meetings. And the moment you start to do that, you're like, wow, if we got rid of this one meeting every week, that's an FTE.
Wow.
Right. It's a full-time person. We got to stop complaining about not having enough headcount because we're wasting so much of our headcount in these meetings. And then the challenge, though, is that there are things you can only do in person, right? It's not all having to be virtual. It's not all defaulting to asynchronous collaboration or email or Slack. But when that in-person conversation now is where the real thoughtfulness happens, because you can read the nuance, the body language, you can split up into small groups, et cetera, then you're like, I want to go to those meetings, right? Because that's where we get work done. Because most meetings, it doesn't feel like work is happening.
Not what work isn't happening. It doesn't just feel that way. That's the truth. And I think that's really interesting, because work is collaboration. Work is decision-making. Work is not just having a conversation about a whole bunch of nothing. So I think that's really, really important. Not just information dumping, not just kicking the can down the curb, right? Just actual decision-making.
Well, and speaking of information dumping, now take that big conference, right? So you got 1,000 people in the room. How much of their time, and you ask why they go, there's usually three reasons. One is, I just want to go to the location because it's different than being here at home, right? I want someone to pay for me to be in Florida, right? That's number one. They don't say that out loud to their boss, but that's obviously number one. Number two is, there's information I want, right? But the truth is, now there's no information at that conference they couldn't have found with a little bit of looking, right? We used to go to conferences because it was curated, it was fresh, it was stuff that we weren't going to see. It was an advanced preview of what was coming. Now, read a blog, follow someone on Twitter, watch a TED Talk, etc. And that third reason is almost always because I can connect with my peers. But nearly every conference leaves that most important part that you can only do together to absolute chance. Right? During our officially scheduled conference, we're all sitting shoulder to shoulder, facing the same direction, watching someone read their slides. And it's only during alcohol-fueled happy hours and dinners, things with bands and entertainment that no one cares about because you're all in the hallway trying to talk to those people, that this connection, this tissue, and everybody in your industry who's there together, you leave it to chance for them to find the person that can impact their career the most. And God forbid vendors now, especially in the virtual world, but yeah, they've got to trade a pen or a little stuffed animal for just a moment of engagement. What if that conference instead were small group discussions, problem solving, the networking happens while you're thinking together, not just drinking together, right? Those ideas, and that's where we're stuck in this model that looks exactly like the conferences our parents and their parents attended. This desire that we have to show and tell the entire time versus saying, hey, these are the smartest people in our industry, and we're going to spend the day, the 2 days, the 3 days working through the most significant challenges. We'll introduce some expertise, and I'll explain a method for doing that in a second. But let's use this event for us to engage around the industry versus just hear people tell us about it. And that drives me crazy. It's just that same problem with the small meetings writ large. And we've built these massive industry around these huge events where you can sit and listen and not engage and call it success.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Well, you dropped a big bomb there that I love. Such a smart bomb, Matt. You said, make networking happen when you're thinking together, not just drinking together. And I think that's really smart. And we forget about that. We forget about doing that. We shouldn't, we 50 minutes of presentation, 30 minutes of conversation, maybe 15 more minutes, you know, the kind of TED Talk style, but with that collaboration that you can only do in person. That's brilliant, man. That's a great way to run a conference. But what about virtually? How do we do that? And how do we make sure that our vendor partners actually get some value out of these meetings?
Well, those are the vendors, the third rail here. We'll talk about that in a second, because no one's figured that piece out. We figured out how to deliver presentations. There's tools that allow us to network a bit online, whether it's Zoom breakouts or some more specific tools that build in that kind of swipe right or chat roulette model of networking. But here's a model, and it's something that works in person as well. And it works really well virtually, is that you know that some people have an expectation when they go to events, there's got to be expertise from the stage, right? I know you're a public speaker. I've done that as well.
Yep.
I'm not advocating that we eliminate that industry altogether. But for that hour slice of time, instead of it being 55 minutes of presentation and then a handful of people kind of holding business cards at the stage at the end, hoping to build a connection with this famous speaker who's about to jump on an airplane, or God forbid, even a panel where the first person goes 25, the second person goes 20, and then there's no time left for Q&A, or the third person who's left kind of holding the laptop. Imagine this. So in an hour time, imagine that that presenter, if it's one, or panel, if it's three, they each the presenter might get 15 or 20 minutes, or the panel might get each 5 or 6. And they give their presentation. They use slides if they must. But then what you do is everyone's at rounds versus gigantic auditorium style. Everyone has a worksheet, again, virtual or in person. And they're capturing the things they like, the things they don't like, the things they're curious about, the things they like to follow up on. And then after the person or people stop speaking, you give them 5 minutes of silence. It sounds like for introverts, it feels like a minute. For extroverts, it feels like 30. But 5 minutes of silence for them to fill it out, to literally process what they've thought about. And then at tables, they engage, right? Again, in Zoom rooms of 5 or 6, or at the table inside the ballroom. And they get to talk about what they liked and what they didn't like with the people they've just met, right? So this is networking without demanding business cards being exchanged, though it happens anyway. And they now have a conversation. Wow, I like that. And then someone else says, the emperor has no clothes moment. Says, wow, I don't believe any of that. I thought that was all crap. And this deep conversation is starting to happen. The speaker can hummingbird from table to table in person, or dropping in virtually if they want. But the key is, out of that conversation, each table has to ask a question, or at least submit one that the table agrees on. So you get, and it's always a dude, and I wish this weren't the case, Phil, you know it to be true, but it's always instead of the dude who stands up and pretends to ask a question with a little inflection at the end, but makes a statement for 10 minutes in front of the room, and everyone else rolls their eyes, pulls out their phone, and otherwise disengages. So by pulling content into much smaller chunks, giving people a chance to process both by themselves and with their peers, and then ask questions, you build a dramatically more engaging 60-minute time slot that you can rinse and repeat over and over and over again, and it feels fresh every time because the content is different. But people have had a chance to think about it. One challenge, you talked about TED Talks. I think why TED initially was maybe so successful is that when people were in person, it was all the famous people, right? I'm in the rooms with the smartest people. If people said, what was so amazing about TED? It's like the cocktail party, the dinner, the reception, the networking. Because watching 1 6-minute talk or 5-minute talk after the next, after the next, after the next, after the next, in what is now the traditional TED style format, is freaking exhausting. And you can't process and think about it when you've got 10 talks in a row before you move on to the next one. And so by building in time to be thoughtful, to allow for collaboration, to share ideas and to capture some insights, and then collectively asking questions that come out of it, deliver a dramatically better experience, I think, virtually or in person.
Yeah. So yeah, building in that thoughtful time, I think, is really smart. Building in that collaboration time where they can actually ask those questions, get those out there, and then the share back, right? Hey, here's what made sense to me. Here's what didn't make sense to me. And then perhaps we distribute them virtually again to now, hey, I had more details about that. I had more questions. Maybe that's where we get our vendors involved, right? Maybe perhaps that's where we can help them, right?
Well, the vendor challenge is the one that I've heard from multiple vendors who, like, oh, this conference went virtual for obvious reasons. I had a virtual booth. No one stopped by. Yeah. Right. Because so and a lot of vendors get the value they're getting from the event is they're not getting the booth time and the email addresses. It's the private suite they have. It's the dinner for their high rolling customers, that engagement, just being there and seeing folks. And we've been working with a handful of other groups. A couple of the companies I've been having conversations like, how do we solve for that vendor? And it takes two to tango. First of all, event planners who know how to build and maximize the space in an exhibit hall are not the people to be having this conversation. You need to have senior leadership from customers and vendors and to start to explore the things that each can exchange that have value to one another that may or may not be something that was in the traditional platinum, silver, bronze sponsorship levels. I think the second thing, though, and this is even more important, is now how do you bring the vendors in even more as experts and participants? If you say instead of them having to be on the exhibit floor, they get to be around, right? They get to drive certain pieces of the agenda. They get to start thinking creatively about problem solving. The Iron Chef model is always a favorite of mine, where you give 5 or 6 vendors an opportunity to solve the same problem in a very short amount of time using their product. right? Now you've turned vendors into the entertainment for the evening or the afternoon, and they've gotten a tremendous amount more value than they would have gotten manning the booth or otherwise waiting for someone to beg them for their white paper.
That's fun, man. I love that. The Iron Chef model, right? Bringing in five or six vendors to solve the same problem with their product, I think is really, really smart. And I think that's really interesting. And to your point, positioning your vendors not as vending machines, but as vendors of information, vendors of expertise, vendors of collaboration, partners, right? That actually are available to solve problems and not just schlep some hardware, software solution.
Well, I'll give you one more example on the vendor specifically, is that I've yet to see a conference do this well, where the vendors are aligned around the problems they solve. Right. So it might be around the industry sector or knowledge management or so on and so forth. But imagine that instead you had big chunks of your agenda designed around problems. Right. So you might have the vendors cut. Each vendor gets a minute. And this is a format that works well virtually and in person. They get a minute to say, here's how I would solve that problem. And I'll be at table one. Someone else comes in. Here's how I'll solve that problem. I'll be at table two. In person, you then give people a map of the exhibit floor so they know that the five vendors who solve this problem are sprinkled here, 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 and here, and here. And they got to trace their way around and have a chance to talk to them. So if I've got a challenge I'm trying to solve in my industry, think about a medical, like I, you know, hopefully everyone's moved to electronic medical records by now. But I'm looking for a new EMR vendor because I want my solution to do X, or I need to deliver virtual care in a dramatically different way than we have before. I get to attend that session, right? So I get each vendor. I know the vendors who purport to solve that problem that's framed as a question as I would ask it versus as an industry sector or a description of their software type of program or whatever it is. I'm going to go watch that, right? I get a minute from each one. I'm like, ooh, I liked what he had to say. I liked what she had to say. That company sounds interesting. I'm now going to spend some time engaging with them at their tables or at their booths, because now I know who they are. And now I know what we're going to talk about in that conversation.
And again, and I know they're not going to pounce on me, right? That's the other thing.
That's right.
Not like, oh, hey, Matt, you got to buy my stuff, dude. You want a pen? You want a pen? You want a squeegee? What do you got? What do you got? What do you got?
Let me scan your badge because my boss is going to determine how successful this was based upon how many emails I get and how many badges I scan.
Yeah. Yeah, which it might be true for that quarter, but it's not true for that year. Nobody gets paid based on numbers of scanned badges. If you do, and you're the CMO or the CRO, you should be fired.
Just saying.
That's idiotic. I want to talk about closed business, qualified leads, right? Real conversations, not some crappy metric of how many did you scan? So that's lame. So Matt, so as we're talking about that, right? So virtually, you mentioned kind of the liquid libation piece of that. And that's one of the reasons you and I connect is we're both craft beer snobs. We both like a really good beer. So I got to ask you, Matt, so what are you drinking these days, man? What craft beer are you enjoying?
So I got to tell you that when Anheuser-Busch got bought by InBev here in St. Louis, is right where I'm sitting, Anheuser-Busch used to hoard brewmasters like Arthur Anderson and Accenture, you know, hoarded accountants and MBAs. And so all of a sudden, when they let a bunch of these folks go with money in their pocket with early severance, our community got the best brewmasters in the world released almost at the same time, and they all knew each other. So we have now, and St. Louis was just voted the number one beer city in one of these online surveys. We have probably seven or eight, and they keep growing. Unbelievable breweries. They've all kind of found their niche. There's the German one. There's the one run by a German who came over here to work for AB. There's the one that specializes in English stuff. I'll tell you my favorite, and it's a collaboration effort. There's a place called Side Project here in St. Louis. Civil Life is amazing. Urban Chestnut is amazing. Like, we have so many good ones. Side Project is a collaborative effort of different brewmasters kind of spending time in their own little worlds, playing with stuff that their breweries would never release, even though they're microbrews. It's a line out the door. Virtually, I haven't bought anything from them since the pandemic, but it's a line out the door to get their special bottled limited runs. and it's weird beer in the best possible way. So Side Project is amazing. Forehand, oh, we've got so much good beer. I can't even start. It's like children, like naming your favorites. You love them all for different things.
Wow, wow. So go to Side Project Brewing when you get to St. Louis, and you'll probably find Matt hanging out there, at least when the pandemic is over, booger. So that's cool, man. So there's a place, actually, fun enough, we've got a couple nice places in Claremont here. We've got Claremont Brewing Company, which is nice. So we've got some here, too, in Florida. So it's good to hear that you got somewhere local. Next time I come to St. Louis, Matt, we're definitely going to have to check out Side Project.
Absolutely.
So that sounds fun, man. That sounds fun. So cool. So because we can't ply people with beer today, because we're all virtual, so how do we incent people to come to our meetings and to participate more so that they can do the things that you talked about?
I think that the one answer is promise and work hard to be good at them. You start to look inside organizations, and the term I always think about our ideal customer is the charismatic deviant, right? The person who gets away with more than they should, who has a reputation for trying new things, who asks for forgiveness, not permission, whose team would run through walls for them. Look at the most successful people in your organization and literally ask them, how do you run your meetings? Because no one elevates that as expertise, facilitation kind of the same way, but the people who get the most out of their teams get the most out of their team meetings. And so that would be where I would start. And I think it's a matter of committing to get good at them. I mean, how much time does someone spend learning how to use pivot tables in Excel? If that's a tool that you use on a regular basis, certainly be good at it. But if you want to get better at being in business, get better at meetings. We have a meeting preparation sheet that asks all kinds of questions. But one of the questions, my favorite part, is we always ask people to identify in the meetings the elephants, the zombies, the squirrels, and the porcupines. Right? So the elephant in the room, every meeting has an elephant, right? It's a thing in the back room that everyone's pretending doesn't exist that's there. But the others are probably just as important, if not more so. The elephants are there in the back of the room. The zombies are the issues that never seem to die. They keep on coming back over and over and over again. The squirrels are the things that distract us, right? The ooh, shiny, shiny. And finally, the porcupines are the things that are hard to share, right? The prickly things. And even by naming them and thinking about them ahead of time, you'll start to find that there's better ways to deal with them. Hey, this is a zombie. We're not going to talk about it today. Or this meeting is dedicated to finally killing the zombie once and for all, right? It's those sort of things, again, having some fun with it, but thinking about and being intentional. For every hour meeting that you have, you should spend at least an hour preparing for it as the owner, probably more than that. Because every hour, if you can save 5 to 10 or 15 minutes off of that meeting, the hour you spent to do that has bought back your organization 3 or 4 hours worth of time, depending upon the size of the meeting. So again, expertise is key. Your peers aren't trying to get better at meetings. And so it's a way to separate yourself out from the pack.
Wow. I love that, man. I love that. Well, before we get into our last thing here, because I want you to talk about Thanksgiving, I just want to share with folks, if you don't know Matt, you're really missing out. You should check out thefilament.com, sign up for his newsletter. If you're in St. Louis, you should definitely think about having a better meeting there, because that, you know, whether it's in person or whether it's virtual, Matt can help you. I mean, just the stuff that he shared today, I know will help me have better meetings. I imagine it will for you too. And one of the coolest things, Matt, that you're working on is this thing called Thanksgiving, which I think is fascinating. I love that next year you're going to go nationwide, but talk to us about Thanksgiving. Like, what was the genesis of this? Why does this matter? And what the heck are you doing,
Matt? Oh, so Thanksgiving, I have what I call idea surplus disorder. I know you've heard that before from me because we've talked about it, because you have it too. Thanksgiving is an idea that I've had kind of tucked away for a long period of time, but at its core, and it's thanksgiving.org, at its core, what Thanksgiving is a chance for innovation strategy teams from big companies, from creative consultancies, from agencies, et cetera, to spend a day paired with a nonprofit focusing on a nonprofit challenge. That nonprofit challenge is not going to be financial, because if you ask a nonprofit what they need, the answer is always more money. But instead, something that's a bit more that moves the needle a bit more for them and that they might not be equipped to solve on their own. So what's cool about it, it isn't just the day. The way that it's going to work is we'll work with all the nonprofits that come up with those challenges. How might we challenges, right? Kind of framed in a design thinking way. And then the for-profits are going to come in and they're going to be a draft. So they'll be able to select a challenge that fits with their industry, their expertise, their team, their philanthropy they care most about. But they won't know the nonprofit it belongs to until after they select. So we don't play, so it's not a popularity contest. So you may get a small nonprofit, a really big one, somewhere in between. And then you spend the day. And so in person, it was going to be together face to face. Now it might be over a couple sessions over the course of a couple days. But we were looking for this really cool way to help people engage with our nonprofit community here in St. Louis. We are a problem-rich environment. We've got lots of nonprofits solving really significant challenges at scale. And how to connect people doing really cool innovation, design thinking, strategy, creative work. And to pick a nonprofit to commit to them for a long period of time is tough. But to say, hey, we're in it for a day, that felt like a really simple thing to ask. And the response has been pretty cool so far. It's happening, obviously, in November. Maybe you figured that out from the Thanksgiving name. And then lastly, what we're doing at Filament is we'll spend a day with each of those nonprofits after Thanksgiving is over and doing a retreat to kind of help them put action to the idea. So it isn't just a day of, ooh, let's think about stuff, let's brainstorm, and then nothing happens. We're going to really work with them to now push that rock up the hill a little bit further. And so it's an opportunity for smart people to work together to solve big challenges in a lightweight way, in a way that's kind of fun, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. Idea surplus disease, right? We've got disorder. That for
it's
sure.
Not but, a disease. Oh, it's idea surplus disorder.
But it's contagious. It's contagious.
That's the problem.
That's why it's right? A disease, right? That's a good thing, right? Hopefully we make ideas go viral. So that's the goal, right? So that's so funny, man. But yeah, so man, I love talking to you, man. We could talk all darn day. But folks, if you want to get connected with Matt Hellman, check out thefilament.com. That's thefilament.com. Check Matt and his team out. Sign up for his newsletter. It's really fun. He's not trying to sell you anything. He's actually trying to help you have better meetings and curate some great stuff in there. I always enjoy it. And Matt, if you had a favorite social channel that people can follow you now, I know it used to be Twitter. That's where we used to hang out. But now, where would you send them?
You know, it probably still for me is Twitter. I don't spend much time on Facebook. With so much of our stuff in person, Instagram, we draw lots of pictures because we always have an artist in every meeting. So there's a little bit of that there. But probably the best place to find me is LinkedIn and Twitter. Old habits die hard.
That's cool. Awesome. 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 Well, folks, I hope you got a lot from this. Hopefully you have some better meetings because of Matt Hellman, right? He says that meetings can be better, but we actually have to commit to making them better. And most people don't. But if you're willing to do that, you can have better meetings and save your company money, many cases than FTE. Thanks so much, Matt, for spending some time with me today. I really enjoyed it, man.
Talk to you soon. Thanks, Phil. It was so great to catch up.
You too, buddy.